Hello, everyone. Thanks for giving us your time today. This is VR Download, and I'm Ian Hamilton in New York, broadcasting today with David Heaney in the London area. To our new viewers, David built this studio for us to meet each week to discuss the next steps of personal computing in live conversation with our global audience. I'm using a Quest Pro right now with face and eye tracking to bring you some of my expressions. And that's it for my intro. David, what do we have today?
Yeah, so the focus of today's conversation will be at the end when we discuss Vario XR4, that dramatic new headset announced this week. But we have four things we're going to talk about before that. We're going to talk about Meta CTO's warning that Quest 3's price will not be cut or discounted anytime soon. We'll talk about Pico extending its 3 VR games offer into mid-January. VR Chat beginning an open beta of paid subscriptions to creators. And Samsung filing a trademark in the UK for Samsung glasses. So we'll get through those four topics fairly quickly, and then the main focus of today's show will be on Vario 4.
Yeah, I'm excited to get into that last bit of the discussion. We'll come back on Vario and exactly what they're offering. Obviously, Upload VR is one of the few outlets that is ending, 2023 with hands-on experience with Apple Vision Pro. And we don't have the Vario hands-on yet, but the specs are very, very interesting and good fodder for comparison discussion. We'll get into that near the end of the show. You ready to dive right into this first subject here, David, with Meta's CTO warning that the Quest 3's price won't be cut or discounted anytime soon?
Yeah, let's start with this. So this was in response to a questioner last week in an Instagram Ask Me Anything session. And so Meta's CTO, Andrew Bosworth, said, "The plan is to stay the course when it comes to Quest 3. We did everything we could to get this device out at the price that it is. That's the honest truth. So the price that it's at is the price it's going to be at going forward for the foreseeable." That's not unexpected. If you tuned into last week's episode, we talked about that Chinese supply chain analysis startup's estimates of the component costs in Quest 3. And that comes out to $430 when you include the assembly cost in their estimates. So if you're factoring in all of Meta's indirect costs, the research and development that went into this, all of the staffing costs, all of the free content costs that go into this, it's not controversial to say that Meta is likely making a loss on the $500 model of Quest 3. Perhaps it's making a non-significant loss on the 512 gigabyte model that is at $650. Perhaps it's even making a slight margin there overall. We don't know, but it's fairly certain that they are not making any money on that base model of Quest 3, which seems to be the most popular. So there is not space for Meta anytime soon in the foreseeable future to cut this headset down from $500. What has been reported by outlets like Bloomberg and the Wall Street Journal and a Chinese analyst who has been reliable in the past is that instead Meta are planning what may be called Quest 3 Lite to directly replace Quest 2 in the lineup at around the $300 price point. Could be, you know, $250, $350, somewhere around that price point that actually can replace Quest 2's price directly. And the report so far suggests that that Quest 3 Lite headset should have the Fresnel lenses from Quest 2, but the new XR2 Gen 2 processor from Quest 3. So it would be like injecting that new processor into Quest 2. We don't know what other features it may have. It could have some of the mixed reality sensors. We just don't know. The report so far just suggests that we use Fresnel lenses. One of the Chinese analysts that was talking about this suggested it could come in the first half of 2024. And that could be part of the reason that Quest 2 has been cut to $250 for the rest of the year. It could be why they were doing that aggressive Black Friday deal that effectively valued it at $200. We talked about last week. This could be Meta trying to clear out that Quest 2 stock in time for a Quest 3 Lite, because this headset, Quest 3, just cannot be sold at the same price that Quest 2 is flying off the shelves at. If you look at Amazon, its top sellers list over the Black Friday weekend, Quest 2 was right up there. There were hours where it was at the number one slot, surpassing any of the other consoles. Quest 2 was the highest selling. Quest 3, I think, got to number 25 at most. So that just shows you how much the difference between $250 and $500 really is. Price matters for this market. As Meta CTO is hinting, Quest 3 just cannot be delivered at the price that most people want.
Yeah, price matters. There's other elements here too of just how many can they make. That has to play a factor at some point, right? Our audience has gotten used to or expecting Meta to try to tear down the price. People who are getting VR headsets or maybe like right in the market for it are always thinking, what's the next generation? And it's really hard for the next generation to go up in price from the previous generation. While you have to actually put these headsets on your head to feel the difference between generation 2 to generation 3. And Meta doesn't have the footprint to really do that in a really great way, right? Like you can go into some places. I went into a GameStop and they had 3 boxes on display, I think, and that was it for the entire VR Quest section. You could see that the Quest 3 box was half the size of the Quest 2 box. But other than that, there was nothing to indicate there was anything different between these two systems to me visually walking in. I like Quentin's comment here in the comments saying, I never understood how important ease of use was until my little brother tried to use my PSVR 2 last week. After finding the sweet spot, fixing eye tracking, and setting up the play space, he lost all interest. That is 100% happening everywhere. That's a pretty common experience, and it's definitely what all these companies are trying to fix with each successive generation, and it is still a big sore point for PSVR 2.
Yeah, that's what we mean when we say the word friction week to week. You'll hear us say that word on this podcast a lot, friction. It's kind of slightly different from ease of use, but you're not incorrect in terming it like that. It's what is the time and effort taken from saying, I want to put on my headset and play a VR game, to being in that VR game. And there are hardware elements to that friction. For example, PlayStation VR 2 has that very narrow sweet spot. So you have to adjust the headset just right and get it kind of clamped in before you're ready to go. There is the kind of setup of the tracking system, having the play space set up. How well does the headset remember your play space? Then there's also the software friction. You know, how easy is the interface to launch the game you want? The game itself contributes to friction. Some games have you sit through 6 splash screens and then go through a complicated series of menus. Other games just throw you straight in there with 1 or 2 clicks. We've talked about this before, that developers often try to optimize for time to fun or time to action, where they minimize the number of seconds from putting on your headset to getting in. These factors absolutely matter for regular people adopting VR. Enthusiasts who love VR and breathe and dream VR, it doesn't matter a huge amount for them because they're willing to do this. But if you want bigger and better games, you want a bigger and larger market of people who are actually willing to put their headset on.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I have my PSVR 2, or at least until last week, I had it set up in the media cabinet. And right on top of the media cabinet was the Quest 3 in its charging stand. And it's just in that setup, right? The PS5 is plugged into the PSVR 2. I can reach into the cabinet in 3 seconds and pull out this headset. But first, the PS5 has to be on. And I need to, I think, press the button on the PSVR 2 to actually activate it. And those 2 steps alone is beyond what it is to just pick that Quest 3 up off the dock and get going.
I never understood the point of the button on the PSVR 2. It's plugged into your PS5. You just use the proximity sensor. That's the first thing I said when I saw Sony, when I met with Sony to try PSVR 2 in the months before release. You know, they're saying the next step is press the button to turn it on. Why am I turning on a headset that's connected to a console? Surely that's not a necessary step, given it's not using a battery. It's not standalone. It just seemed like a very odd design decision there.
So we're going to move on here shortly to Pico. But before we do, I want to talk about the price here of Quest 3 and the fact that Meta is giving us an indication they're going to try to hold the price right here around $500. And that's a big deal. And I think it starts to explain some of the other news that we've got developing, that we've been harping on week after week. Our audience has been on this journey with us and is starting to get a picture, I think, of what's happening. And if you have a next generation processor winning the market or dominating at Meta Meta's set price, and you know that Meta's going to take that processor and put it into a cheaper device within 6 months' time, it's time to kind of pull up stakes, shift gears, whatever terminology you want to use. It's time to close up shop and start something new. If you were building anything above these prices, right? Like if you can't beat 500, how can you ever hope to beat, what, 300 or 200, whatever price they end up at with a Quest 3 Lite? So it explains some of this later news that we're getting to in a very clear way, I think.
Yeah, if the recent reports are true that there may not be a near-term successor to Pico 4, if that's really what we're seeing from ByteDance, then Meta is really going to be in a category of its own. As you say, there already is not a like-for-like competitor at 500. If there's then a $300, Meta is just kind of growing the market further and further in an uncompeted space. But as we will talk about later, it's the high end where they're going to start to face competition from companies that are going to come up with multi-thousand-dollar headsets that push the quality of the experience before they try to push the number of people who can afford it.
I guess there's two things that I think about, I guess, before we move off of this subject to the specific next subject. And it's the first thing is all the delays that we've seen from games this holiday season. I'm wearing the Stranger Things outfit that I purchased from the Meta store to just have that experience of what it's like to buy an Avatar outfit on that store. And I did it in anticipation of the Stranger Things game coming from a very talented, interesting developer that's done really interesting things in VR. But its last, like their last project was, I think, Virtual Reality 2. This is Tender Claws. And it was buggy, very, very, very buggy at release. So it was kind of expected that maybe they wouldn't hit their launch timing for this game. But that game in particular is one of many that have missed the season because of the QA process. You were joking today about that image that is circulating, referring to the devs who are having to deal with quality assurance on both PSVR 2 and on the Quest ecosystem. And it's just pushing a ton of stuff out in the next year. I wonder whether the Quest 3 Lite figures into any of that decision making and how it relates to the mixed reality situation that we've been discussing. Stranger Things VR was going to be a game that was meant to put a very big focus on mixed reality, on the pass-through worlds that you can kind of merge. Stranger Things is the perfect content, right, to have worlds merging, but everything we've indicated or seen indicated about Quest 3 Lite is maybe it won't put the focus on mixed reality. So there's all these games that could be coming to the Quest ecosystem, but Meta has absolutely no reason to say it's coming now. And in fact, with many of these games getting deferred into next year, they could be deferred partially to ride the wave of a Quest 3 Lite, right?
Yeah, I mean, I think that a lot more of those delays are happening on PlayStation VR 2 than Meta. We are seeing Quest games coming out every week, and obviously you've got Assassin's Creed and Asgard's Wrath 2, and Arizona Sunshine 2 is still on track. And you've seen the opposite happen with Arizona Sunshine 2, which is something we've seen with a few games, where they're actually releasing their Quest 2 version, and that's what will be on Quest 3 with minor enhancements. And then they're not doing a full Quest 3 upgrade until next year. And yes, that could be a factor where they're waiting for a larger market of XR2 Gen 2 headsets with the Lite coming out. When it comes to mixed reality, though, that is the one thing we really don't have any reliable reports yet about Quest 3 Lite. I think there was one report that strongly suggested that it will not have the depth projector, but we don't know whether it will have color pass-through or black and white pass-through. We just don't know these things yet. We don't know, will Meta be able to do some scene understanding without the depth projector? Would it perhaps just be a slower and less precise scene mesh that gets generated? We don't know any of these things yet. That will be the big open question, because if they do ship a Quest 3 Lite without room-aware mixed reality and with, say, grayscale pass-through, that's going to limit the market for mixed reality. It's going to keep it as what it's been currently in most titles, a kind of add-on bonus feature rather than something that developers really build their core experience around. If it does support mixed reality, though, that will obviously over time give developers a much bigger incentive to support that as the active user base of Quest 3 and Quest 3 Lite over time eclipses Quest 2. And note I'm talking about the active user base, the number of people who actually use their headset every week, not just the number of units sold.
So a couple interesting comments there that I want to address that are sort of off topic, but still interesting. Paradise Decay asking us, did we see the latest PSVR trailer before it got taken down? It looked very interesting. Yes, it did look interesting. It looked very CGI. It looked a lot of computer-generated depictions of what it's like to go into VR rather than actual gameplay. So we're going to hold off on like running away with any speculation on what was seen in that trailer, because that's what it looked like to us, right?
Yeah, it was clearly just one of those CGI, this is what it feels like trailers. It was not supposed to depict the actual experience. The graphics were far, far beyond what any console or PC can do today. I think that first game that people are talking about, again, I will speculate a little bit. It could just be No Man's Sky. It could be Red Matter 2. It could be just generally indicative of the PSVR experience. You know, it said underneath, not actual gameplay, and that's pretty obvious.
So Onikaze has this interesting question here that I really want to highlight. What is happening to the pass-through that doesn't make it as grainy when recorded or streamed, but is through the lenses? If it was low light for the camera used, wouldn't that show in recordings? I bought on Amazon one of those eye charts that they use at the doctor's office. It's about this big, and it's supposed to be used about 6 feet away from where you're looking at. I take that eye chart, I put it on the ground. It's supposed to be viewed at six feet. Look down at it. I don't think I'm going to be able to read what would be 20/20 vision on that bar chart looking down. I'm sorry I haven't tested it before coming in here, but this is the perfect subject to bring up this problem where any videos you see coming out of a headset are going to be whatever resolution the cameras are recording at. Your eyes see at a completely different HDR. I mean, all those things that various scientists have put up and researchers have put up on stage to show, there's a massive gap between what your eyes can process and what those videos show. So anytime you're ever seeing video, you're seeing the way it looks to a video, not how it looks to your eyes. And I'm wondering if that's what Onikaze is describing there or not, because it might be describing something completely different. But I do notice this recurring again and again and again. And we need to like really change the way we talk about this a little bit, because it's endlessly frustrating to see people so excited by the prospect of pass-through as shown through these videos, while not understanding that your eyes are going to be dramatically different than that video.
Yeah, I think there's three factors going on here. One is just that you're seeing this grain is much easier to see when it's magnified over 110 degrees of your field of view compared to on a little rectangle in front of you when you're watching a video. The other factor is that a lot of the influencers who are recording these pass-through videos and going, oh, whoa, look at the pass-through, they're doing it in ideal lighting. They have, you know, all of their lights turned on, their windows opened. They're choosing the best lit part of their home and then lighting it even further to give off the best experience possible, because they want their video to look good. For, you know, a lot of some certain influencers, like hype is a part of their brand and they don't want to show negatives in this way. And another aspect is probably just the fact that it's potentially possible that the way that pass-through recorded is slightly different than the way that VR apps are recorded. Because if you remember, the pass-through before an update on Quest Pro didn't even show up in recordings. And to an application, there is no pass-through. The pass-through for an application developer is just specified as kind of a blank layer, and then the system compositor adds in the pass-through, either as an underlay or an overlay. It doesn't really exist to the application itself, and that's why developers don't actually have access to the camera feeds, even if they hacked it, even if they had, you know, an Android app that forked the Oculus SDK. They can't access that feed because the app doesn't see the feed. So it's possible that the pass-through when it's recorded is actually just being sampled directly from the camera without the reprojection, because you don't need reprojection if you're just doing a single eye recorded view. That's very possible. And from then you would get less distortion in general, which is something you kind of do see in recorded videos. And you would have a higher quality image that hasn't gone through the multiple processing steps that might amplify that grain that you see.
Yeah, I don't know if this is going to go too off subject even than we already have, but there's very clearly like a collapsing of the tool sets between making games and making movies. You're having shared spaces a lot more. The tools for making movies with games are getting way, way better. You've got situations like The Mandalorian where people are filming in this giant a ring around them, providing light and combining that with everything that's happening physically in the scene, as well as just shots of complete CGI that are meshed together. You never, ever notice it. And those tools are getting produced with like, sometimes VR headsets are used in that production process to visualize the shot. Sometimes they could be used even more so. Like we've had in the studio a producer of a movie that went onto HBO and the entire thing was shot. And there are extensive tools for field of view, for depth of field, for all those things you want out of VR chat. And it's one of the things we saw being toyed with Banter, as we talked about last week. The idea that you can film with your VR headset or your AR glasses is really, really interesting. And I'm frustrated, David. Like, I've had the Ray-Ban Meta glasses for weeks now. I've been filming with them every day almost. They're cool. I've got gigabytes and gigabytes of footage from these new glasses. But like, it's missing. It all feels like it's missing something. And what it dawns on me is like, these glasses are taking, I love the videos, but I don't know what to do with them. It's like having a GoPro, but nothing you want to film with the GoPro, right? Like, I want to take inane moments. I wanted to capture inane moments of just walking around New York and seeing interesting things around me. But where do I put that? There's nobody to show it to. There's no editing program to edit with. And it's hard to describe this because a lot of our people out there haven't captured video like this, but it's a different type of video to connect with a person one-to-one, not have this posed situation. So you don't have to pose for the videos you capture with a VR headset or smart glasses. So you need new editing tools. You need maybe special effects tools. What I'm getting at here is these glasses make you feel like you need to be doing action to make them useful to capture. They're driving you to perform for the camera in a certain respect. And I think it's just so interesting. I've also got the Mocapi full body trackers, right? Sony is doing the same thing, right? You could theoretically do motion capture and then clean it up on a machine and send it into a VFX pipeline, all from these body trackers that you wear anywhere combined with a VR headset. A lot of the products we talk about, David, we don't talk about them in depth because they're probably going to get used for these other purposes than just everyday viewers looking to have a great VR experience. But this is a big thing that's happening constantly. Every VR conference you ever have, you have Vicon and OptiTrack representing a major portion of the spend in visual effects and VR markets, selling cameras to track bodies and movements in various positions. It's going to be a really, really, really big deal when you can do really good full body tracking and then layer in 3D special effects following the motion of subjects through the scene. We're seeing inklings of this with some of the AI tools out there, but the beginning of editing tools aren't even here for the format that's being captured by some of these glasses, right? All right, so I saw an interesting comment there. Do we want to respond to that one?
Yeah, the comment here from Vexner asking a question they've asked before, where they're requesting an article that discusses the charts out where current VR and presumably mixed reality headsets are from reaching the minimum thresholds for human senses. So we'll talk a little bit about that later when it comes to XR4. Like I said at the start of the show, that is our fifth topic. We're going to quickly move to our second topic here now. We went a little bit off topic there. So I'll come back to that comment when we talk about XR4 at the end, because it's something we were going to discuss anyway.
All right, let's talk about Pico.
Yeah, so this is an extension of part of the Black Friday deal. So Pico 4 had this Black Friday weekend deal where the headset's price was cut by like 100 euros or so for each model, roughly. And it also included Warplanes: Battles Over Pacific, which is a game I really like. You know, it's one of the few flight sims that is native on standalone, and it's a combat flight sim. The World War One title was their first one. It was great. This is their World War II version, and they now have a modern version as well. But yeah, you know, it's a fun game. It doesn't have the same depth as a proper PC simulator. But if you're someone who doesn't own a PC and you're just wanting to play, you know, fly a combat aircraft and have dogfights and throw bombs in standalone VR, it's a fun title. There's nothing else really doing that other than Ultra Wings 2, which is a little bit cartoony. Green Hell VR is obviously, you know, we've talked about that on Gamescast in the past, I think. Then also the third game is obviously the biggest, which is the upcoming blockbuster Arizona Sunshine 2, which brings a whole new campaign and adds Melee for the first time. The thing I really hated about Arizona Sunshine 1, I loved that game, to be clear. I loved playing it with friends over the pandemic, but I hated that there was no melee. So when you ran out of ammo, you were completely useless. It's great to see that in this game, you can just pick up something and smash the zombies in the head. Together, this is like 100 euros of value. So this is really ByteDance being aggressive with their offer here. This is through to January 15th. So they, you know, we thought it was just a Black Friday bundle, but it's through to January 15th. Pico 4 is kind of priced between Quest 2 and Quest 3, but with this, it gets much closer to being actually below Quest 2, though keep in mind Quest 2 is at $250 for the rest of the year. Obviously, though, this doesn't matter to you at all if you're in North America where Pico 4 is not sold.
So if anybody accuses Upload VR of not being balanced, of not trying to tell both sides, I'd like to point to David Heaney's report just now. Everything he just said right off the cuff is giving credit where it's due to this amazing deal and how it could be a great entry point into VR. You get pancake lenses with great games and you're ready to go and experience VR this season. But, right, but, we have to say this is not a good idea at the same time as saying it's not a good idea to buy Quest 2. Why do we need to say that, David?
Yeah, so the first reason is the same reason we no longer recommend buying a Quest 2, which is that Pico 4 and Quest 2 use the original Snapdragon XR2 Gen 1 chipset from 2020. It's 3 years old now. It is starting to show its age. We recently saw gameplay of Arizona Sunshine 2 running on Quest 2, which is likely very similar to how it looked on Pico 4, and it does not look good compared to the type of graphics being delivered on Quest 3. We're just at the moment where this new generation processor, the XR2 Gen 2, with more than twice the GPU power, is available. It's a generational leap in graphics. We don't recommend being stuck on that old generation. We don't recommend pouring hundreds of dollars or pounds or euros into being stuck, because as XR2 Gen 2 becomes the norm over time, developers are going to put less focus on making their games look and run well on the original chipset. So that's the first reason. The other reason is something Ian can go into more detail on, as he did some of the reporting on this, but it's the recent news of ByteDance, the parent company of Pico, laying off a significant percentage of the company, including most, if not all, of the content team, and restructuring the business to focus around the hardware. Presumably, and this part is my speculation, the past part was just reported fact, the next part is my speculation, presumably because they want to invest in the longer term and try to build the kind of headsets that will be truly mass market in the second half of the decade and into the 2030s, rather than focusing on the near term VR gaming market. So there is the same reason we don't recommend Quest 2, outdated chipset, and the other specific reason to Pico, which is its future in VR in the short term is extremely uncertain. I'm going to bring up a comment here from Laggy Luke suggesting that you can't play Pico on PC VR. You absolutely can. There is a built-in Link-like feature. It's not as good as Link or Virtual Desktop, but there is also Virtual Desktop on the Pico store for the same $20 and the equivalent in pounds and euros, and it works great. In fact, Pico 4 is one of my favorite PC VR headsets. I still use it over Quest 3 for certain use cases because Pico 4 has a taller vertical field of view. And this is something that I've really come to love in certain headsets. One of the things Valve Index did really well, and I don't think even a lot of people who love Index quite articulated this because they just saw it as a bigger field of view, but it's really the height of the field of view, the vertical field of view that matters. So we'll talk about it later, Vario XR4, how it was one of the major changes for it. But yeah, Pico 4 is an excellent PC VR headset. You have that lightweight form factor because of pancake lenses and a rear battery. You have the pancake lenses, which are not quite as good as Meta's in Quest 3, but they're still great and they're a lot better than any of the Fresnel lens headsets. So you get all of that for, in the Black Friday deal, it was down to like £250, £260. It's a pretty good deal. Obviously, yes, we've pushed back on some of the reasons you don't want a Pico 4 because of the outdated chipset.
It's not looking good for the current generation of Pico. If you're looking for multi-year support of your system, I would be willing to bet you're going to get more support out of the Meta Quest 2 for longer and Meta than you're going to get out of Pico 4 because of the investment levels differing. I could be wrong on that. Pico could surprise us. They could come back, or ByteDance could come back and say, we're actually throwing massive amounts of money at the next generation of their hardware in some new fashion. And there is a plan to sort of upgrade all the old content from this system. But I think this is really tough because a couple of years ago, we were warning people about making the decision of buying a Quest, right? When you bought a Quest, you were buying into an ecosystem that would last you years and years and years. And that's the investment you're making in a content library. Plenty of people out there have years, decades even, of content stored in their Steam content library. Now there's years of content being stored in the Quest library. Your ability to switch systems later decreases with each dollar you spend into those ecosystems. And so what we're saying is there's a safer bet in your content dollars going and buying a Quest than going and buying a Pico right now. At least that's my personal opinion. But you're still, I don't know, I would still favor or suggest people like it's still great to go out and get a PC VR game. I love adding things to my Steam content library, but there's just so few people out there getting PC VR content compared to those getting standalone games.
Let's talk about the third topic, because you really want to get to talk about Vario XR4 fairly soon. So let's talk about the big news that VR Chat is opening paid subscriptions for creators.
Yeah, kind of a big one. What service would I compare this to, David Heaney? What would you compare the way people are going to use paid subscriptions on to other services out there?
Yeah, I don't know if there's a direct comparison here. I guess in some ways you could compare it to the likes of Twitch, but it's really more, from what I can see, that people are going to pay subscriptions to worlds. So their favorite worlds that creators put a huge amount of effort into creating, that they, you know, throw events in, that they have their custom avatars for, and all of this effort that's put in, you can see people wanting to do that. You can see the options here are 1 month, 6 months, or 12 months. This is currently a limited beta, so it's only for certain creators, but it is going to be rolled out in 2 weeks when the open beta becomes a public thing. The interesting thing here for me is the spending breakdown. So 50% of your money goes to creators, which is interesting because that's obviously lower than the 70% that a lot of top layer platforms like Steam and Google Play and Meta Store would give creators if they're creating for an app store. But the difference here is that VR Chat is not making a massive amount of money here. They're actually only making 20%, 30% goes to the platform holder. So that's Meta, that's Steam, that's Google Play, depending on which platform you're on. That is very interesting here. So, you know, you may say, oh, only half goes to creators, that VR Chat's being greedy, but they're only taking 20% themselves. It's just that there are three different groups getting money from your subscription here.
Yeah. I'm going to go out there and say that this looks competitive to me, to OnlyFans and Twitter. This looks like this is VR Chat's version of a subscription like that. So I'll go on record saying that. And I'll be curious to see, you know, who the first person to make $1 million on VR Chat is, and how far away that is. I know Rec Room is actually working towards monetizing their their customer base. People can build things in VR in a rec room and feed them back to the community and make money that way. But obviously, the rec room community is entirely different than what's happening over in VRChat. So we will see where that goes.
Yeah, this is all obviously a huge part of VRChat's pushed open a creator economy. They don't want to just have this be a free service forever. Obviously, the app is free. A lot of the economy within VRChat is going on right now off platform. People are buying avatars mostly. You know, you have this decent economy that people are make custom avatars for people, but that's not something that VRChat gets a cut of. When it comes to world, people obviously sell some world assets and things like that in the same way that a lot of that would be bought off the Unity asset store. That's still not money going in to VRChat. This is the first attempt, obviously, to start to monetize. VRChat has raised a lot of money from investors, and they're going to want to start to see how is that funded. You could see how over time they may want to integrate one-time purchases rather than just subscriptions. But obviously, an investor's favorite thing is this monthly recurring revenue that you see here. It'll be very interesting to see how well this goes. One thing I didn't realize is that there's already monetization until recently. There's already monetization in Horizon Worlds. There's the ability to kind of sell things for tokens. And there are some worlds where people are actually spending significant amounts on that. There are creators making decent incomes there. It's obviously something where you have in Rec Room tokens. They have a certain creator program there. That is the end goal for these platforms, is that it's free to access, but you pay for user-generated content. So it's an entirely self-sustaining economy for the platform holder, be that VRChat or Meta or Rec Room.
Yeah, a lot of people throwing out ideas for the way this might be used. Interesting things. I mean, that's the way David outlined it is kind of like an open field for VRChat to bring some of the transactions that are already happening around VRChat into VRChat. And the sky is the limit, I think, for like that being a successful idea for VRChat. Like this could, I think this was described, David, as one of the biggest changes to VRChat in its history.
Yes, for sure. And they plan to have an even larger announcement on the creator economy in general in January. So we'll be keeping a close eye on that.
I would love to get up a chart. I don't know if we've got it pre-made, but there is a chart that we could throw to basically compare the way Horizon Worlds divvies up its platform payment versus the way Meta takes its platform payment for the Quest store, and then compare that to the way VRChat breaks this percentages down. I don't know if we could get the same out of Rec Room, even though I could put that question to them. But it is possible for us to kind of outline for our viewers out there the way Meta is trying to separate the fee that you pay to be on the Quest store from the fee that you pay to get represented on Horizon Worlds. And it's like layers of how deep into the Meta ecosystem you are, if you look at it that way. And I think of whether other companies are going to ever offer something similar. Ready to talk about the next subject?
Yeah, the last thing I'll say is that, yeah, it will be fascinating over time to see how much of VR content in 5 years and in 10 years exists within these quote-unquote metaverse platforms, where it's all kind of within an application layer rather than on a store layer versus what is on the store. I suspect that we'll see a larger and larger percentage over time. Already on PC VR, a huge percentage of the engagement is in VRChat. And even on mobile as well, you see on the Quest store, the top played, VRChat and Rec Room are always there. Even in recent months, Horizon Worlds has started to be there in the top 20 as they've made those massive improvements to delivering worlds with custom imported models made by a professional internal studio. I can't see that trend reversing. It seems like the appeal of free entry is going to be a huge grab for people, even though the creator split is very, very different. But yeah, let's talk about the Samsung Glasses trademark.
Yeah, I'm surprised. I find it interesting how many people in our chat sort of don't understand VRChat, or that's not their crowd. I mean, I understand that myself. VRChat doesn't have a huge lure to me personally to use on sort of a daily basis, but that doesn't deny that there are those people out there that get enormous social connection from getting into VRChat. And I've met people who you know, they meet up in VRChat, make friends, and then they continue those connections outside. And that's pretty, what we're looking for as like an organization is to see what the overall trends are there. Is it going to become a commonplace thing? And our service is going to be successful built around that interaction. And VRChat is the one to watch in that space. But let's talk about Samsung filing for Samsung glasses. Are these the things we've been talking about all year? Or are these something else, David?
That is one possibility. So this trademark is for Samsung glasses. It's in a trademark category, and it has a description that could cover pretty much anything we would talk about at Upload VR. It's in the kind of augmented reality, virtual reality, mixed reality, smart glasses category of trademark. So it could be that. It could be that headset that Samsung has officially announced it's working on, with Google providing the software and Qualcomm providing the chipset. That would be a Apple Vision Pro style, or, you know, if you want to be more broadly general, a Quest style headset with, you know, a VR style display system with the lenses and the display, plus pass-through cameras that show you the real world through a reprojected pass-through view. That could be what this Samsung glasses trademark refers to. The other possibility is that we should take them at their word or at their trademark, and that these are glasses. And that obviously splits into two sub-possibilities. The first one I'm going to rule out, which would be AR glasses. And the reason I'm ruling that out is because, as we talk about many times on this show, the technology behind AR glasses is still in its absolute infancy. It was reported earlier this year that reportedly both Apple and Google have indefinitely shelved their AR glasses projects. It's also reported earlier this year that Meta has scaled down the specs ambitions of its first consumer AR glasses, which reportedly will not come until at least 2027. So that's 4 years out. I think it's very unlikely that Samsung is about to release a dramatic breakthrough project before they even release their headset. So what seems to be the other sub-possibility here is that these are smart glasses. We've seen Meta recently release the smart glasses that you frequently talk about on the show, the Ray-Ban Meta glasses. Those are camera glasses that let you take pictures and photos and stream to Instagram. You can take phone calls on them, and the microphone array is actually really great. So that's one of the ideal use cases. It's like just hands-free phone calls. You can listen to music on them, though that's not an ideal use case, obviously. Then we've also seen smart glasses that have a few more features, such as the X-Real Air series, where they give you this fixed to your head virtual screen that you can plug in your USB-C display devices like a tablet, or with an adapter, a smartphone, or your Nintendo Switch, and you get this portable TV screen. It doesn't have a very wide field of view, so it's not a huge screen relative to what you could do in a virtual reality headset, but it's there. So that could be something Samsung's doing. We could see either just Meta-style audio and camera smart glasses, or X-Real style media viewer smart glasses. I think that's probably most likely here, but again, we don't know. All we have to go on is this word, Samsung glasses.
Yeah, and I like the comment from Aaron Davis here just saying, could also just be protective trademarking for an inevitable future device. That's an interesting idea. And the only issue, I guess, with that suggestion is that at some point, the company needs to actually ship something to make use of the trademark, right? Like, and what we could be at here is one of these things where, yeah, the trademark exists and the product never ships. But it's at a moment here, the fact that Meta is on generation 2 in 2023 can't be indicative to these other companies like Samsung that actually they need to get their data hoovering in place now in order to offer anything competitive a couple years down the line.
Yeah, Samsung is a wide net hardware company that jumps in on a lot of things. You know, they have everything from dishwashers to fridges to, you know, I'm pretty sure smart microwaves. They kind of jump in on most opportunities. As soon as the smartwatch market took off, they're there. I've seen among the wider tech media a really positive reception to the Ray-Ban Meta glasses. People do seem to be actually a huge fan of it, which is interesting because the Ray-Ban Stories, which were a quite similar product in many ways a few years ago, didn't get that same traction. Maybe it was just an example of the wrong the right product at the wrong time. Maybe it was just cultural norms evolving. Maybe it was just all the little things that make the Meta glasses superior, and including, you know, Meta AI and the ability to live stream and the kind of lowered friction between getting footage from your glasses to your phone to where you want to post them. But companies like Samsung are going to see that reception. You know, outlets that trash the original glasses, like The Verge, are fawning over the Meta glasses. So this could very well be an opportunity for companies like Samsung that see this has got a good reception. Why aren't we in this market?
I like Artful's comment there that a company needs to trademark a device called Oranges so that Ian can compare apples to oranges officially. I like it. It's actually a really good idea. It's actually a better name for Android, I think, if you call them Oranges, because then it would be, yeah. Thank you. Thank you for the dad joke. Thank you for appreciating me. Are we ready to talk about Vario yet? Because that is going to end up being our big subject of the day. I appreciated you saying that, like, the first gen Ray-Bans were a flop, and people are appreciating the Gen 2 ones, and the Gen 2 ones are not even fully featured yet compared to what Mark Zuckerberg said they would have at the Connect event. If you try to lay these generations down against the Quest line or the VR headset line overall, it's hard to figure out where they sit. Is the Generation 1 of Ray-Bans similar to Gear VR, or is it more similar to Oculus Go? Is it similar to the first Quest? Where are we going to be on the curve of adoption for smart glasses, and how is it going to be affected? Like, the problem I'm having with the smart glasses, and I'm gonna go away from this subject for now, but like I'm watching Twitter feeds and I'm seeing threads and I'm seeing the changing way we feed all of our content into social media, and one of the things I saw pop up on my feed was a tweet from someone saying normalize shutting down people who record everyday interactions. And it was a fast food worker flipping the bird at a customer who was recording that interaction. And we as a society across multiple nations have kind of agreed that recording your perspective, recording your car, recording your house, is all within fair game to protect your property. And that's, we're gonna deal with situations where people are like recording their perspective to protect themselves, and that's going to make other people uncomfortable. And we're going to deal with that as a society very, very, very soon. And we don't know how that's going to shake out. And I just have to like point it out as a thing. It feels like the elephant in the room that nobody's talking about. Our cultural norms are going to shift with all of these device launches.
Well, nobody's talking about it except us the past 3 weeks in a row. So I think, you know, we have covered this topic quite a lot.
It's like I'm delaying. I want to keep talking about it till I release the article, because, like, I don't know. I need a way to talk about the fact that this feels cool and uncomfortable and the future all at once, right? And there's people that aren't going to buy into Gen 2 that are going to get into Gen 3. And it feels to me on a similar trajectory of, say, Quest 2 to Quest 3. People that, you know, Ray-Ban 1s weren't good. Ray-Ban 2s are close. But Ray-Ban 3s, that's feeling like Quest 2 to Quest 3 to me, at least personally. Like, that's mass market appeal when you can answer people's questions as quickly as they expect them to get answered. And the thing that they're asking a question about is in their field of vision. I think that's Meta's hope by Gen 3 of this platform. And if they get there, that is Quest 2, Quest 3 market share, in my opinion.
Yeah, I don't think smart glasses are anywhere near at that point yet. I think they're still missing some of the core features that are going to be key. You know, this thing doesn't have a display yet. What's being reported by The Verge and by the information is that the key feature they want in the Gen 3, which is reportedly targeting 2025 launch, is a small HUD display, not AR display that you can pin real objects in your room, but just a heads-up display, and you can use that to frame your captures. You can use that to translate text in real time. You can use it to get notifications. I think that's when it really starts to have value for people, because as you said earlier on, there are not a lot of people who do interesting first-person things that they want to capture. That's not a huge use case unless you're like a snowboarder or a mountain biker, or you kind of do a lot of like fancy cooking, or you're doing like mountain, you know, motorbiking or driving, all of these things that you can't do. You can't have your phone in your hand while you're recording. That's the kind of real use case of the capture part. It's very rare that people are going to want to use that's something that they're actually going to spend $300+ on a product for. But when it starts to become something that it gives you kind of useful contextual information in the visual field, yeah, that's when it starts to take off. And that's for me when it gets to kind of the Quest 1 point for smart glasses. But just before we move on to Vario, I'm just going to reply to two related comments here from earlier. James O'Loughlin asked, Horizon Worlds has importing now. And Clayman made a comment that's somewhat related, saying Horizon Worlds feels like I'm in a Fisher Price advert. I can't do it. So the reason these comments are related is that, yes, Horizon has importing for certain creators. A few months ago, Meta launched an internal game studio to build high-quality games inside Horizon. You've seen that with the shooter game Super Rumble. You've seen it with the RPG-like game Citadel. In the past few weeks, we've seen that Meta has started to roll out those features to other creators. And the worlds that are made with these imported models and textures look dramatically different to the ones that are built inside VR with just primitive shapes. The primitive shape ones, they very much so do look like Fisher Price. But when you get models and texture importing, it starts to look a lot more like what you're used to in VR chat and even in native titles. So that is obviously, Horizon is currently going through a massive transformation when it comes to how worlds are built and what kind of graphics are possible. And as that's happening, we're seeing it climb up and up the charts of Quest's current most playing ranking.
Yeah, great explanation there. And I love the model importing being indicative, right? Beyond that, ends up getting to ray tracing and like transparencies of surfaces. You start talking about the lighting tricks that platforms can support to really make you feel like it's there. And we're a long way away from that happening in any mobile platform. But that is the path. And David is pointing out here that Horizon Worlds is getting further along that path in a dramatic way this year. And it's going to have, you know, someone at Meta is placing a big bet that this is going to actually get the product market fit that Mark Zuckerberg has basically been asking his teams for years now.
Yeah, I think Meta has heard loud and clear over the past few years that Horizon's graphics just aren't good enough. You know, they've been ridiculed throughout the tech industry. Meta is not blind to that. It's just that when the entire point of Horizon was that it's designed around being able to build everything in VR with primitive 3D shapes using your controllers, pivoting that to, oh, actually, this isn't going to develop. This isn't going to spawn a metaverse that people actually want to engage with and that looks good outside of VR. You need to actually have real 3D models. That's where it changes. I think the dramatic thing that could happen in the next few years is what happens when AI models are able to generate proper tri-mesh models with textures based on just your voice. That's something we've seen very early prototypes of in research, but it's not impossible that in the middle or second half of this decade, you can walk into a platform like Horizon and say, give me a chair that's, you know, slightly wide and this color and this material there, and just point to it and it'll appear instantly. And you just describe and point to exactly what worlds you want to build. And at the speed of thought and pointing your hand, you can generate an entire virtual world. That's the kind of user creativity that the AI is going to make possible very soon on the grand scale of things, not like as in a few months, as in a few years. And that's when these user-generated content platforms like Horizon could get very, very interesting.
I hate to play into the branding games and give them credit where it's due, but I'm seeing in our comments people talk about this idea of people discovering things like Super Rumble in Horizon Worlds and then discovering other things on the platform. That's the product market fit that Meta is exactly searching for right now. And once they find it, there's this other question asking, why isn't it in Australia right now? Once they find the product market fit, that's when it makes sense to do the global rollout in a much more focused way. Hit the big nations one by one as you're spreading out globally, but only do that when you have a platform that gets people in, keeps them coming back again and again. The thing that I think is a little scary or a little intimidating that David and I go into with this transition, it's just how much of the VR ecosystem at large does Meta suck in to Horizon. There's no reason why VR developers can't go and make a Horizon entry space for their VR game. And you go and buy the game in the Horizon entry space, wait for it to download in the background, and then invite other people to play with you. I think something close to that gets us nearer to the vision David has discussed for years on this show of effectively getting us into spaces together and then getting us into a world we all want to visit together. Meta is building a funnel of people into their ecosystem, and Horizon is the place where Meta either wins or loses the war for like having the biggest funnel. And it begins with product market fit, making something that people want to come into, stay with, come back to. And then once they've got that, everything becomes Horizon. So I think of it as like Meta is what the Greek word, is it beyond? Horizon is the entrance. Meta is everything you do beyond the Horizon entrance. And I think that's a good analogy for how Mark Zuckerberg is probably thinking about what Horizon represents to the Meta brand. Everything else Meta does is going to be beyond the world you visit in Horizon, the people you meet up with there, and then everything else is open to you from there. And right now, it's just a joke to even consider that, right?
Yeah, I think when it comes to technology, it's very easy to deride the current state and not look at what it's going to be in a few years. I've already seen in the past months, some people say, you know, I never expected that I would actually like and want to use Horizon, but I find myself, you know, playing Super Rumble or Citadel or some of the user-generated worlds where, you know, there are things from comedy clubs to all of the same kind of thing you'd find in VR chat, but just there's obviously a little more polish. It runs more performantly on Quest. That's going to be a big focus of Banter, the VR chat competitor as well. And obviously you don't have, you know, some people love the furry anime cat girl avatar scene. A lot of people, it just turned them completely off platforms like VR chat. Some people, you know, you always see the VR chat diehard say, oh, why would anyone want to be in Horizon? You're a human. You're not a furry cat girl. Well, that's actually what a lot of people want. They want to just show up as a human and like character and see other people rather than having whiskers. That's what a lot of people want.
It's funny. I mean, think about the unsolved problem of taking a selfie and then giving a person an avatar from that selfie that's animated like ours are animated and represents the way I've spent years in Meta's avatar generator fussing with the tools to try to get something that I feel like represents me. And that's a whole nother unsolved problem that if you get that solved where people see an avatar that's reflective at the base, then they can go and do the weird avatars on top of that. But getting them really, really close to what they want or to look like right out of the box is a huge unsolved problem that, again, will make this an easier way to get into everything.
So yeah, as Kenzie7km says, let's talk about XR4 now. We've tried to move forward. Obviously, we had some technical issues, but I think we've done a little bit too much rambling on side topics here. Let's go straight into the big topic of this week, Vario XR4, the headset that Vario claims will have by far the best pass-through mixed reality in the world. It is obviously being sold for around $4,000 for the base model or around $10,000 for the model that has autofocus cameras. And it's that $10,000 model that they claim achieves near retinal resolution in pass-through that is almost indistinguishable from natural vision. Now, that is obviously a very hyperbolic claim that they're making there. There are obviously huge caveats to that, but in general, they are pitching that, you know, you put this on and it's going to feel pretty similar to a transparent optic, despite the fact that you're seeing through a display system and pass through. So how do we want to talk about this? Do you want to give some thoughts first? Or do you want me to run down the specs or what way do you want to do this?
Well, I think, David, so I appreciated David's framing of this in the headline, catching people's eyeballs with their claims here. If you go read his article, he has an incredible breakdown of these specs, what the promises are, and the areas that our commenters are already questioning, right? You've done a fantastic job in that piece of qualifying everything Vario is claiming, as well as giving credit where it's due with some specs that are absolutely eye-popping to our audience out there. They want this, but they need to know whether it delivers. And even if it does deliver, what's the hope of it ever achieving, you know, this stuff ever coming down back into the prosumer consumer price? Or is this what governments are going to use to police their people, David? Or is this eventually going to become a consumer device?
So this is primarily for enterprise and governments, and not to police their people, but you know, the government use cases are generally military, for military simulation. There are also other aspects of, you know, intelligence agencies want to simulate certain things. Some of the customers that Vario says it has secured for XR4 include Volvo Cars, Rivian Automotive, and one of the lead makers of simulators for the US military. You know, for example, there's an F-35 simulator that uses this. But yeah, let's just run down what this is for anyone that's not aware or hasn't, you know, been fully up to date on this. So Vario is this Finnish startup from Finland. And they, since 2019, with their VR1 headset, their unique selling point has been that in the very center of your view, in about 27 degrees, you've had retinal resolution, meaning the same resolution that the human eye can no longer discern beyond in theory, but only in the very center until now, because whereas those old headset used a micro display spliced into the image in the center, this new headset uses just a single display per eye, a 4K LCD per eye. And it's actually it's not like Apple Vision Pro where it's near 4K. This is a kind of true 4K, 3840 by 3744. And that gets you 28 million total pixels, which is more than Apple Vision Pro. That means that because these lenses have such a variable distortion where it's less warped in the center than at the periphery, in the center, despite the fact that they're not using separate displays, in the center, you get around 51 pixels per degree. And that compares to the 60 pixels per degree that is generally accepted as the threshold of human vision. These are LCD panels with mini LED backlighting, so you get local dimming. It's 200 nits, which is double the brightness of the previous model. And one of the really impressive things they've done here is dramatically made the field of view taller. So the old model had a field of view of 115 wide by 78 degrees tall. But this XR4 has 120 degrees wide by 105 tall. And if you remember before when I was talking about Pico 4, I was talking about just how impactful the vertical field of view really is. This has the same vertical field of view as the likes of Pico 4 and Valve Index, while having a wider horizontal field of view than either. And so that's just the display system. The other magic is in the cameras. So Quest 3 uses dual 4-megapixel color cameras to give you that real world of the view of the real world. The Vario XR4 has 20-megapixel cameras. And as I alluded to before, the high-end Focal Edition model that's $10,000 has autofocus, gaze-driven autofocus. So it uses the eye tracking to adjust the camera focus to what you're actually looking at. This isn't varifocal. They're not adjusting the focus of the lens you're looking through. They're adjusting the focus of the camera capturing the real world. And Vario claims that the combination of these 20-megapixel sensors and this gaze-driven autofocus delivers 51 pixels per degree of pass-through resolution, the same 51 pixels per degree of your actual VR vision. So they are claiming that you get this same near retinal resolution in pass-through. That is obviously a dramatic difference from Quest 3, where if you're in pass-through, you can notice that it's a lot lower resolution than the VR experience. It's one of the things we talked about in our Quest 3 review, that when you're in experience in mixed reality, where you're shooting away your real wall to reveal the virtual world, you're stricken by just how much better the virtual world looks. That's something that Vario claims is no longer an issue here. It also has a high-resolution LiDAR for really, really good dynamic occlusion of your hands and other objects. There are situations where, for example, they have a flight simulator where the cockpit is real so that the person can interact with the switches directly, and it's masked out or occluded because everything behind the cockpit becomes virtual. That's a really interesting way to do a flight simulator where you don't have that 2D issue of old flight simulators that just use giant displays. It's also the first Vario headset to come with controllers through a partnership with Razer. They look a lot like Quest 2 controllers, the same sort of style of, tracked by the headset with IR LEDs. It's also the first Vario headset to come with built-in speakers and microphones, and it also has inside-out tracking, so you no longer need the Steam VR base stations and, you know, Index or HTC controllers that the older headsets needed. So this is a dramatic improvement in many ways. To be clear to anyone who's not aware here, this is a PC-tethered headset. This requires a very powerful PC with a high-end graphics card, which it is cable-tethered to. This is not a standalone headset, but this is for, like I said, enterprise and government use cases where they want the highest fidelity VR and mixed reality possible. What I should say, though, is that they will actually at a later date sell this to individuals who want it. It's hard to imagine many people buying this, given that it's, like I said, the base model is $4,000. But it is something that if you are a wealthy early adopter that happens to already have a beastly gaming PC and you want the best, and if you $4,000 is something you're willing to spend on the headset, they will at some point in 2024 sell this to you if you really want.
I'm seeing people talk about Razer. That's a name that came out of the darkness to haunt me with this. Razer was the company behind OSVR, right?
Yes, they were.
Yeah, one of the worst experiences I ever had in a VR headset was trying OSVR back at one of the, I think it was E3, and they were right across the way from the Oculus booth. And the Oculus booth obviously had some really good Rift, I think, experiences. And then right across the way, they put me in a wipeout type experience without positional tracking, with a camera above the play space to give me the indication that it was probably active and tracking my position, but it wasn't. And before even, you know, moving, I was ready to throw up. That was the last experience I had with Razer. So seeing Razer come out of the woodwork with these things, what are these things? Like, I mean, do you have any indication about what these are beyond that they've teamed up with Vario?
They're just standard VR controllers with a thumbstick and buttons, the same style we've seen, you know, that essentially Oculus launched touch controllers back in 2016. Then they launched the Quest Touch where the ring was on top, and pretty much every company has copied them since. And maybe copied's too strong a word. There's not very many other ways to build a controller like this, but it is the simple case that these are rings with infrared LEDs, just like on pretty much every other inside-out headset. And there are four cameras on each corner, just like on Quest 2, that track these. Obviously, they also support hand tracking with an optional UltraLeap add-on. UltraLeap was built into XR3, but it's now an optional add-on, which is an interesting sort of turn of events. There's also an optional Steam VR tracking add-on if you really do want the base stations rather than inside out tracking. That's something that's there. There's a comment here. They're asking what the lenses are. Are they aspheric? Artful, I think. Yes, these are aspheric lenses. So you're going to get, you know, almost pancake lens sharpness, but there's a trade-off with aspheric lenses, which is you do get this geometric warping around the edges. And we asked Vario, you know, is this fixed with your aspheric lenses? And I think they were, you know, they didn't kind of directly answer, but they indicated that it is improved over previous Vario headsets, but it is not fully fixed because it's,
so several comments
as far as
here,
you know, not fixable.
Yeah, so several comments here. Aaron Davis saying, I feel like it would be easier to develop for Vision Pro than Vario and have a wider corporate audience. And then Aaron following it up with saying, and Apple runs on privacy, and privacy capitalized as almost it's Apple's brand now, and they've made this their brand over the last couple of years. And then there's another comment here to put with that. Let's see where it goes. Talking about the price, right? The price of this, yeah. Artful saying, the cost reveal of this makes the $3,500 for Apple Vision Pro seem reasonable. Really, really interesting. And I love that it's like, last week we were doing the math of how many Quest 3s you could buy to go get a Vision Pro. And now we're doing the math on how many Vision Pros you could buy to get a Vario. And it's silly because we're never going to have a period like this again in this market. These developers from Big Screen Beyond to Vario are clearly trying to maximize every different aspect of their spec portfolio. And it requires prices that are absurd because you're buying, in some cases, probably the world's supply of some components in order to get there out to first to market. So it's a weird space with things like this, multiples of headsets being the way the math works. It's been like that for the last couple of years. I don't think it's going to be like that for the 2030s, at least.
Yeah, you have to factor in the PC cost here. So not only is Vario's headset, for even the base model that doesn't have the retinal pass-through, more expensive than Vision Pro, but you have to then also add the PC, which to get a PC that's going to really drive the kind of content that's being used on this and take advantage is going to cost you about the price of a Vision Pro. So you're talking about, if you want the focal edition with the near retinal pass through and a PC to run it, you're talking about four Vision Pros. But that said, there is an advantage here. This is, you know, a PC isn't just a requirement. It is also a way to deliver dramatically higher fidelity graphics. The graphics that you can deliver on the kind of PC you're going to run this with, you're going to have something like, off the top of my head, probably an order of magnitude more graphical horsepower than you have in an M2 chipset that's being run by a battery. It really is that level of fidelity. You're talking about companies like, you know, Volvo Cars here and some of these large engineering companies being able to visualize their systems there, you know, be it a car or a jet engine or a helicopter or a bridge or whatever it is, at full fidelity without having to, you know, decimate this model down to run on a chip. They can really drive this in real time and see every little detail of what they're working on, as well as mixing real and virtual with, you know, really, really, really high quality occlusion and the ability to, as I mentioned earlier, a use case like have a real cockpit that you can interact with, plus a virtual background. So I'm looking down and I'm seeing at full near retinal quality the exact switches that are in the aircraft that I'm training for. If I'm a fighter jet pilot, for example, this is something that, despite this cost, this is actually relatively affordable to something like a military or a large company. I remember if you read the book, The History of the Future, about the founding of Oculus and the story there, there was a moment where, if I'm recalling correctly, it may have been Palmer Luckey was talking to a military person and they were asking, you know, this is incredible, this Rift, how much is it? And he said 350. And they're like, oh, really? $350,000? No, $350. The simulators, the virtual reality simulators that the military used to purchase back in the 90s and even in the early 2000s cost $500,000 or even $1 million. So this is actually dramatically lower than what it used to be while delivering a dramatically world-shatteringly better experience.
Yeah, we're getting an accusation of being Apple fanboys here for not mentioning how expensive the Apple Vision Pro. I don't think that's an accurate assessment of how we've talked about the Apple Vision Pro's pricing over the last record of this show. I think you could go in and find the clips of us mentioning the price nonstop and just how that puts it away from where the consumer market is, which is sub $500. In fact, sub $1,000, right? That's, we focus so much of our energy and our time talking about that price range and the products in that price range because we know that's going to affect so many people out there. What's interesting when we talk about prices, you know, devices that are priced this high, is you have to have a very, very serious use case to justify that expenditure. You need to be building a car or a building or something that's going to cost hundreds of thousands to millions or even billions of dollars to construct. And if you want to see pixel for pixel what you're going to build before you build it, something like this makes the most sense for you for that purpose. Now, I asked that joking question about, kind of joking, about whether governments will use this to police their citizens. But you also said that hand in hand with this being used for military training and that being a very useful case for this. I think there's an argument to be made that we're talking about the same thing. But what the reason this is relevant is because Magic Leap, a couple years ago, took a massive investment from the Sovereign Fund of Saudi Arabia, I think it was. And the moment that Magic Leap did that, the company died to some people who were watching that company. Like, they just became a non-serious effort and an effort that they no longer supported or were interested in because they took money from that organization. I would be curious who has the majority share in Magic Leap today and what that technology is going to be used for over the long term. And it's fairly interesting that in the marketing materials for this device, Avario makes clear that the Secure Edition is put together in Finland, as Onokazi points out. That's kind of an indication or, you know, to try to let buyers know that we're taking extra secure precautions with this platform. You know, I'm raising alarms here. David, how do you think about the security implications of what these devices are going to be used for and how that matters to the buyers of these devices?
Well, I mean, Vario is unapologetic about the fact that they work with these kind of companies, that these are used for military training since their first VR1 headset. That's been one of the use cases. There was, if I remember, a story where it was being used to simulate tank drivers so that they could be trained more cheaply. This is something that it's not going to create an entirely new kind of use case. It's just that they are, you know, lowering the cost of training. That's something I have to keep repeating, that when we're talking about the price here, doing this virtually is cheaper than operating a real vehicle. I've seen some of the comments talking about how certain fighter jets, for example, cost, you know, tens of thousands of dollars an hour to run. Yes, this Secure Edition is more expensive. It is, I think, around 10,000 for the, around 8 or 9 or 10,000 for the base model, or about 14,000 for the Focal Edition. But as you say, it's assembled in Finland, so there's no risk of supply chain sort of sabotage that has been an issue with some products. So they know this is being assembled in Finland. It doesn't have any wireless components, which means it can be used by insecure environments, by, for example, like intelligence agencies, which would need to make sure that they don't have wireless components that could be sending back information to anyone. I don't see why this would matter to those buyers, because this has been one of Vario's focuses from the very start.
Sure. So, like, whether to be clear, like, the answer you're answering, like, whether it's $5,000, $9,000, or $15,000, what matters is the secure element of this product. And Vario has a track record of trying to put that first and foremost. So it's not necessary, like, if they've already got a customer that wanted security, they're already serving that customer and they're trying to do it even more so. I'm asking in a broader way, right? Like, you talk about the economics of this being cheaper than it was before. Are you telling me that it's now much less expensive to train militaries with these headsets?
Yeah, when it comes to expensive vehicles, this is going to be the case indeed, where you can train someone on, be it a fighter jet, a helicopter, an armored vehicle like a tank or other vehicles, without having to operate them. It's not just that you can do it cheaper, it's you can also train more people at once, because instead of having to dedicate the, use all of the trainer jets and bring only a class of a certain amount of people, you have arbitrary virtual ones for a fraction of the cost, and then you can easily weed out who are the most promising candidates. You can start hands-on training a lot sooner. there are obviously going to be massive. This is one of the use cases of VR in enterprise we've talked about a lot. It is training. It's not just in military. There's many other contexts here. In medical fields, for example, you can do virtual surgery. This is an example of where, you know, you can put on a headset like this and they can have, you know, a near retinal view of the of a simulated cadaver where they have sort of a virtual organs that you're operating on. There are many, many potential use cases of this for training.
Yeah. So I just want to make sure that full context is out there of just the seriousness of the use cases that we're discussing for these headsets is a completely different realm than the gaming use cases. And I saw it in our comments. We're so appreciative that we have these long-term viewers who do tune in to us because we're not just talking about the games week after week. We've built up to hundreds of people who tune into us every week because they're starting to realize that we're one of the only places that are diving into this wider picture than just games at this level. And Vario and the market they've built for themselves is one to watch. The investors in Vario and the customers of Vario are ones to watch. Toby eye tracking, same thing. Who owns Toby? Who invests in it? And who are their customers is something to watch, because what we're building, we've just spent the last 15 years labeling journalists everywhere. I'm not saying I haven't done this, but by and large, the market of Facebook, Google, Amazon, to an extent, it's been labeled as surveillance capitalism. And what we're talking about here is way, way, way more cameras, way, way, way more sensors used around you in every single way. And these companies are after those markets while also trying to prove that they're not doing surveillance capitalism.
Yeah, but when it comes to headsets like these, and when you do get to these enterprise products, they're not making their money from collecting user data and advertising. That's not the revenue model here. That becomes a big factor when we ask the question, how long until headsets with capabilities like this, near retinal resolution and pass-through, arrive in consumer devices for under $1,000. That's going to be an interesting thing to chart here. It's something we will obviously be charting at Upload VR as this industry progresses over the decade. It'll be really, really interesting to compare the pass-through on Vision Pro to this, because Vision Pro is obviously constrained by using, it has to be done on board on a mobile chipset. It's constrained by having to run off a battery. You know, it doesn't matter to Vario how much energy these sensors use. It's not a factor at all when you're connected to a power socket, essentially. That's something that's going to be fascinating to see. And it's also going to be interesting to see over time, how quickly do Apple and Meta and Samsung and companies like this catch up to the capabilities, and how much do they eat of Vario's market? Because, you know, beforehand, Vario was kind of in this realm of its own, but when it came to resolution, but now you're seeing Vision Pro likely get very close to this. You know, Vision Pro has not as many pixels, but it's similar resolution. Its distortion profile is probably a bit more even, so the resolution will be very much so a lot more consistent across the lens, which means it won't be as high as 51 pixels per degree, but it's still going to be competitive in many ways. And Vario is really kind of holding on to this idea of the PC is their moat, you know, that Apple is focused on standalone, Meta is focused on standalone. The few companies that are focused on PC, like HTC, even them have pivoted out to standalone. And Vario is standing strong, saying, you know, no matter how close these headsets catch up to us from other competitors, we're the one that's focusing on the capabilities of what a NVIDIA graphics card that is literally an order of magnitude more powerful than an Apple M2 can deliver.
Yeah, and I don't know, this is going to be off subject, so apologize in advance, but I saw some comments earlier in our show asking about whether the Mac can be used as a powerhouse to power the Vision Pro, and what that kind of looks like, right? Because they could do it both at the visual industrial industrialization end, where they need to have their most powerful Mac processors streaming some of that stuff to a Vision Pro. And hypothetically, like, you could do some serious things with that workflow. Your local Mac doing all the processing of a giant model with a ton of detail, and then sending that over to your Vision Pro. That we've heard rumors that they've thought about things like that, even at a hardware level. There's no reason why they couldn't, like Meta did, come full circle at it with a software solution to do that kind of piping of high quality content. What I want to ask is this effort that Valve has done to get a lot of its library running on Steam Deck, a lot of its library running in Linux. How much of that library is runnable on an M2 processor?
None, because the processor itself, or on Vision Pro with Vision Pro's operating system.
No, I'm asking the work. What is? I can't remember the name of the work that Valve has been doing here to try to get all of it. Proton, yeah. Is it?
Well, Proton is the compatibility layer they use to get it over to Linux. Yeah, I mean, I understand what you're trying to say here. The on a Mac, this is something that's already possible. We've seen Apple has its own translation kit now. The problem is that Vision OS is just so based on iOS and iPad OS that it's not something that's going to happen there. But let's talk about what you're actually bringing up here, which is the prospect of Apple using a Mac, say your Mac Studio or a future Mac Pro, to drive the visuals that are much higher fidelity than are possible standalone. You're absolutely right to say there's nothing technically stopping Apple from doing this. It is something that they could theoretically do, but it doesn't seem like something that Apple would do. I think we see in the comments from Aaron Davis, Apple would never admit that it's not flawless standalone. It's a hard sell for Apple to say, you know, here is your $3,500 headset, but it can be so much better with other than the chipset that's built in. Again, it's so interesting because you're right that they could actually go straight into a market like Vario's, but is that a market that Apple cares about in terms of how big it is? Is it a market that if Apple can take enough from just use cases where an M2 is enough? We've already seen examples of visualization of be it jet engines or Formula One cars in Vision Pro. Do they actually need to do that and kind of architect from that? Because what we've seen over time is not that Apple tries to focus on the Mac, but that they try to focus on the iPad Pro. Mac OS is becoming more like iPad OS, not the other way around. The computing device that Apple push in their marketing outside of the people who are ready Mac users is very much so the iPad Pro. And I expect that with Vision Pro, they're going to try and over time sell this as a replacement for a MacBook in the very long term, not as an extension.
Well, okay, yes, that's right. But why not do the extension in the meantime? And you're right in it being not Apple-like, but what gets me here is that now is the time to kind of like sacrifice your old platforms to give your new platforms a chance. And I think of this in terms of what Meta's doing, right? The people look at Pico and say, Pico can't be dead. Like, why would they toss out that name? When I immediately bring up TikTok being the bigger effort and realizing, oh yeah, well, actually that is the bigger brand there that matters to that effort. Apple has the iPhone brand that is absolutely critical to everything they do, and it's going to be their biggest moneymaker for years to come. But Tim Cook is keenly aware that if they don't get started with the next platform, they're toast. And the easiest way to do it is use your old platform, like they are, with letting you access a large percentage of your iPhone and iPad apps inside the headset. But here's this Mac platform that has been, less than 10% of the PC market for its entire existence, going back 30 years, I guess not to its entire existence. There would have been a time in the 80s that Apple had a chance of dominating the PC market, but it for the last 30 years, more or less, Apple has never rose above to be a large percentage of the PC market. And I, even now, they've got all these awesome, like these computers that last hours and hours and hours of battery life. They have really done this this magic trick with their processors where you can run the processors at peak performance and only use the power right then, and then shut it back down, and you've got this device that lasts 10 hours, 12 hours. It's fantastic. That's great. But they're not doing anything else with this legacy Mac platform that is going to change the fact that they're not selling the same number of Macs as they do. Like, they're not as dominant in the Mac sphere as they are in the iPhone sphere. And I think it's absurd to imagine Apple is just going to let that continue.
Well, I think a huge problem here is the revenue model, where the App Store on iPhone and iOS is where people spend their money, right? Every transaction you make on an iPhone or an iPad, unless it's through Safari, if it's in any app, you are either purchasing app or spending money on in-app payments. Apple is taking a cut. Whereas on Mac, yes, there's an app store, but the majority of software does not use that app store. It uses their own installer through that you download through Safari or Chrome or your other web browser, where Apple isn't getting any of that revenue. So Apple's only choice in the Mac is to make this massive, massive hardware margin, which I'm not saying they don't make on iPads and iPhones. They do, but it's not to the same degree as Macs, where it's never going to be as big as Windows when the cheapest of the cheap starts at above $1,000, whereas the cheapest Windows laptops are $200. That's something that, you know, yes, iPhones are more expensive, but there still is the possibility to get iPhones for when they're refurbished, or some of the older models for as low as $400. That's done through a subscription, obviously, through your carrier. It's also, if you look at iPads, that is one area where Apple is price aggressive. The base iPad is actually priced more competitively than the vast majority of comparable tablets. You know, you've seen it starting as low as $300. That's where Apple is being aggressive, because again, they can rely on not just the hardware margin, but the software margin. That's another reason I don't think they're going to want to integrate the Mac as much with Vision Pro. Yes, on Vision Pro, you can bring up your Mac screen and use it. But in terms of actually bringing in VR and AR content streamed from the Mac, that again is not content that you're always going to be purchasing from Apple. That's going to be, in many cases, stuff that goes outside. Whereas on Vision Pro, you are locked into using the App Store. Every transaction goes through Apple, and driving up the fidelity of that natively is a much, much bigger effort at Apple. Not to mention that Apple's quality barrier when it comes to streaming technology, they would want to use a direct Wi-Fi connection or an adapter. I do not think Apple would ever accept an Airlink style solution that would depend on your local network.
Well, yeah, I remember going to CES years and years and years ago and seeing Miracast, and Miracast was this open industry standard arriving just months, it seemed, after Apple kind of stole the thunder by announcing AirPlay. And so here's this Apple-branded version of this wireless streaming that kind of is in use across the industry alongside Chromecast and the industry standard version. They develop parallel, but Apple chooses its moments to ship things first when they're beneficial. And I have to go back to that moment of being at Apple Vision Pro's launch, going up to one of the Apple executives who is known to have a racing simulator in his house. And I asked, what headset do you use for that? And he stopped me. He's like, no, that's not a good idea. I'm not going to answer that question. And I was asking, are you looking forward to doing this with your Vision Pro? And that question was also like, yes, but it was also in reference to the previous question. So David, I hate this, bugs me so much, because it's almost like a repeat of the PSVR 2 on PC question. And we're going to do it over the next 6 months or year until Apple does this. But it would mean so much to so many people. I saw Guy Godin. Let's go to Guy Godin, who's been in our comments this whole show, virtual desktop creator, and actually probably one of the world's best people to ask about the subject. And Guy, a couple comments back, said that backwards compatibility and gaming are the reasons macOS isn't thriving. And here we have Guy Godin, the creator of Virtual Desktop, the person who put PCVR on Quest first, officially, before Meta would officially support it, saying that it's one of the things holding back ecosystem. And he also, Guy also left out this teasy little smiley face. I wasn't going to let it slide by, talking about how Apple needs something like this. So, Guy, I've talked a little bit here. I'm curious what comments he has to make of the prospect of whether we'll see what we've always thought as PCVR games streaming from a Mac to an Apple Vision Pro.
Well, just to kind of touch on that, there's nothing, why would it have to be a Mac? There's nothing stopping a developer like Guy Godin from making Virtual Desktop for Vision Pro. Now, the only thing that may be stopping it is Apple Store policies. We don't know about that. But when it comes to a technical aspect, there's nothing special about Vision Pro that means it couldn't do what Pico and Vive XR Elite and Quest 2 and 3 and Pro can do, which is just someone makes an app that streams from your Windows PC. The issue with Mac is that the vast majority of the VR content on Steam just doesn't support macOS because there are no native runtimes from Meta, and Valve drop support from Steam VR. So you could theoretically build a Virtual Desktop as its own VDXR runtime. There are a bunch of reasons that's harder to do on a Mac, but yeah, the market isn't there. Gaming people who want to play gaming PC games, it's not only because that they don't like macOS, it's because they can't put macOS on a PC that they build themselves. Other than, yeah, there was a Hackintosh project a few years ago that I think some people still do, but that's a side note. You can't, there's no reason that would happen on a Mac. Apple would have to really want that to happen themselves and build it out. And as we've discussed, there are reasons they wouldn't do it. But yeah, let's bring up Guy Godin just saying that he will develop for Vision Pro when he can get hands on it.
Yeah, it's all about being accepted into the store. There's no technical limitations other than the absence of controllers. What a full response from Guy Godin there. That's a pretty big comment to get. Thank you for responding to me, putting you on the spot. I appreciate it. And
we'll have to
keep that one in mind.
The lack of controllers, that means that people are going to have to spin their own controllers for this. Obviously, yes, you can use Virtual Desktop with hand tracking to emulate
with my two iPhones in midair. Is that what I'm going to be doing?
So how are you going to push a thumbstick, a virtual thumbstick?
Yeah, I'm going to have a little touchpad on the thumb. That's what I'm going to do, right? I'm going to have an iPad in this hand. And oh my God. All right, I'm sorry. We've had a very large audience. Is there anything else you want to get into before we sign off today?
Yeah, I'm just going to talk about that a little bit more. The lack of controllers means you're probably not going to be able to use Vision Pro anytime soon to play games like Half-Life Alyx or Vertigo 2. But as Guy is saying here, when he says it limits the types of games you can stream, there's no reason that games that use other peripherals, such as flight simulators where you're using a HOTAS, or driving simulators where you're using your pedal and wheels, that they couldn't be played. You know, you brought up Phil Schiller's answer that he plays racing simulators. If Apple will approve an application like Virtual Desktop onto their App Store for Vision OS, there is no reason that you couldn't use Vision Pro to play these driving simulators. But that is obviously a wildly different question to the question of would Apple ever officially try to do this? And then that's an even bigger question of would they change their entire approach to the Mac to try and bring VR games there while kind of splintering their core offering from Vision OS? I think it's extremely unlikely.
All right, I'll put Guy back on the spot here. If Apple Vision Pro supported out of the box gamepad tracking, how many of the games that people use Virtual Desktop for today would be really playable in that fashion? Like, do you think you would get a large cross section of what people use Virtual Desktop for today in Apple Vision Pro just via gamepad recognition?
I mean, obviously not. You don't have two different hands there. The vast majority of VR games, you're interacting with two separate hands. They work because you have these different hand controllers. Vision Pro, if its hand tracking is good enough, it already does track a gamepad, because by knowing where your hands are and you're holding a gamepad, that's already a given. But We had this discussion so many times where people just want Vision Pro to be this Quest-like headset with controllers. It's just not happening. It's not, Apple is not making controllers. A gamepad cannot substitute for touch controllers, and an iPhone doesn't have either the tracking capabilities nor the haptics that you need for buttons. And how are you going to do the grip triggers? How are you going to do the back triggers? You can maybe
stop breaking my heart, David. Stop breaking Geek Odin's heart. He's not going to invest money in this. He's too smart. But I'm breaking my, you guys are both breaking my heart. Stop it. It hurts. Okay. We want this. They're going to figure it out somehow. I know we don't need the gamepad tracking, but like it's still, if you go to the simulators, you talk about a flight stick, a driving wheel, a flight stick, and a gamepad, and you get a large segment of very, very impressive experiences. If you make the software experience of syncing those things up effortless, and Geek Odin's app will be there doing it for us, if Apple allows it, right? And how messed up is it going to be, Gee, if Apple doesn't let you into the store with even, you know, because Apple reserves that space for themselves? Like that would be more hurtful than Meta doing that, right? He's telling us it doesn't seem like they're going to do that, right?
Well, we have no idea what Apple's policies are going to be like. There is a huge possibility here that for the same reasons that Apple blocked some streaming software like xCloud in the past, they could potentially block it on those grounds because of the way it accesses a storefront. But there are ways Gee could design around that. We don't know yet. It's also possible that Apple will say that, you know, the quality of experience of depending on a Wi-Fi network is not something we want to support when it comes to being in a headset. That is something they could do. We simply don't know. A lot of comments here are talking about, you know, oh, the Rift, original Oculus Rift shipped with just a gamepad. Anakazi saying Apple is not making controllers now, as far as we know. I think all of this is just cope. It is absolute cope. Apple specifically said in the WWC presentation, they called them clumsy hardware controllers.
Pencil is a clumsy hardware controller.
And yet the Apple Pencil is not supported on iPhone to this day. Steve Jobs said, people always talk about this Apple Pencil in the context of a stylus for a phone. You still cannot use an Apple Pencil on the iPhone. That's for a tablet, which is a completely different form factor of device. You do not present a product and say, this is great because you don't need clumsy hardware controllers while you're developing controllers. It's just, people want it to be true so badly, but it just isn't going to happen.
All right. Well, I'm going to put it in my collection of clips that I keep. You ever seen Billy Madison when the Steve Buscemi signing names off the wall? I've got a clip section of every time David Heaney tells me that Sony is not going to support PSVR 2 on PC. And every time he tells me that gaming is not going to be supported on Apple, I've got a little file of the clips when he says that.
I didn't say gaming. I said tracked controllers. That's a very different question. There will be lots of gaming happening on Vision Pro. We know that Demio will be there. We know that Rec Room will be there. I'm sure there will be many other developers that port in the years to come. That's a very different question to tracked controllers with thumbsticks.
All right. Well, I appreciate the commenter who says we get more animated and fighty near the end of the year. I think that's turning out to be true. Thank you all for tuning in. It's been a very lively discussion. Next week and in the weeks ahead, we are building up to the end of the year. We've got our Upload VR showcase coming up with lots of content submitted to that. Kyle and I are going to plan to come into, we're going to plan to do a live video chat. I don't think we'll do it from the studio. Talking about a bunch of the projects we chose not to include in the main show. We decided to keep them for our live show where we'll just talk about them. That's coming up next week. It's going to be a big show. And we've got a couple of surprises and things we're working on for the end of the year and into next year. I just booked my travel to CES. I was doing my best not to go to CES, but I think I got to be there. So we're going to go to CES, check that out, and we'll see how it goes. But it's going to be very likely I'm going to go to CES, come back here, sit down from a flight, and go right into the studio with David Heaney talking about the things I saw at CES early in January. So we've got a big lineup of a couple weeks ahead for everyone. Thank you all for tuning in. Please consider becoming a member, supporting our work, and we'll see you in the future. Thank you so much.
Thanks so much, everyone. Again, we will see you next week.